I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, encouraging you to eat healthfully and nutritionally. Visit bobsredmill.com to learn more about their products. And use the code TASTE25 for 25% off your order. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And if I ask you to think about Sicily, what comes to mind? Do you think about the beautiful beaches, the architecture, some of the Roman ruins, the bustling cities and markets? Right. But Sicily is about so much more than that. So tied to the land, so tied to the food. And my guest today knows a lot about it firsthand. Fabrizia Tascalanza was born and raised in Palermo. She went north to study and live for several years. Her mother, meanwhile, was a well-known cooking school teacher and cook on their family vineyard that's been in the family for ages. We'll find out all about that. Family vineyard and the farm. She ran a very successful cooking school. And finally, in 2010, Fabrizia decided perhaps it was time for her to come home. And the rest is history, if you will. So I'm very pleased to welcome today my guest, Fabrizia Lanza. Welcome, Fabrizia.
Hello, thank you.
Now tell me, you came back, you had a career as an art historian and children and living in the North. What made you come back?
Well, first of all, I went away when I was 18 thinking I would never come back. And while in my 40s, I'm also an only child, and there were very deep reasons why I came back. First of all, a sense of responsibility, because I felt I had to choose very carefully if I wanted to interrupt the chain that my grandfather, my mother, I mean, a lot of members of my family had created this kind of soul, this kind of love, this kind of passion for the land and for the property. I'm an only child, so if I left forever, this would have been, who knows, I mean, interrupted. And so this was very deep in me. Without really not understanding properly what it was about, because I think that when you're very young, you don't know that there are things that you can't build in one generation. You don't have this sense when you're very young. Aging, you understand that love, soul, pile up. And so this was the reason, first of all. And then a more subtle, maybe, reason, I wanted to eat a tomato that tasted of tomato. I was fed up.
Back to the farm, as yes. I say, right? Right. How long had your mother been running the cooking school when you came back?
My mother started in 1987. And she was running it. This was in 2010, so she was running since 25, 33 years, more or less.
And then sadly she passed away.
And then sadly she passed away, and I took over, and now it's me running the school and moving on.
Mm. Well, I was fortunate to observe firsthand last evening that you were giving had written the menu for a dinner that was actually cooked by my son, which I'm very proud of, and or his chefs, and a book. You had done a book signing, and you were walking around the tables. And the majority of the people there, I was very impressed, because the majority of the people there were all people who had attended the cooking school and felt so strongly about the influence that you had that they traveled. Some people, as you said, traveled quite a distance to come back for this dinner and see you and visit with you. That's quite something.
Yeah, that's quite something. It's true. We have between 300 and 400 people coming every year at the school. And I would say a good 60% are Americans. The rest is Northern Europe or UK. And the loyalty of American people and the interest Americans have for what I can share with them is uncomparable. And I don't know if this has to do with the loss that Americans always complain about cooking, about eating habits, about good ingredients and all this stuff, or it's nostalgia for a ideal country where the food system is still somehow in place.
Did you go out back and you pick that fresh tomato?
Exactly,
you said,
exactly.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, this is an interesting topic. We could talk about this for hours. It's a complex topic because it borders mythology, romanticism, deep needs.
Heavy on the romanticism, definitely.
Right? Yeah, but also deep. Romanticism starts because you have a need, an urge, somehow.
No, and it's nostalgia, as you said. It is a nostalgia.
It is a nostalgia. And so, in some ways, and also, I mean, at the school, what we do is it's not a common cooking school. What we do is it's a participatory experience. So people are not just, you know, tourists drinking or receiving from somebody else the information. They're a part of it.
It's a true hands-on cooking experience.
Yeah, they're also part of habits, of ways of being that are endangered, and so they also feel somehow that they're giving a contribution to the maintenance, to saving all of this, which is important.
Well, obviously you had so many of the same feelings, and it affected you. Now, what I didn't say in the introduction, because I knew we would talk about it, is that it was probably a little bit of a difficult shift, writing and teaching about art and art history, to suddenly being thrown into the food world, which you grew up large part with. But you went on to write 3 different books, and Coming Home to Sicily is the one in particular that I think elucidates the flavors of and the feeling.
Yeah, Coming Home is a cookbook, so it talks about the flavors. It talks about this this feeling of being overwhelmed, because I came back and I hadn't kind of technically spoke my language, eaten my food for 20 years, although I always ate Sicilian at home. I mean, it's not that I was, and I wasn't in Australia, I was in Verona, so.
Yeah, it was still, Italian, even though it wasn't Sicilian,
yeah,
it was Italian.
I know, we have this thing, but you know, it is another world, it is another Italy, it really is another Italy. They eat polenta, we eat pasta, cioè, they eat rice, and we have cucina, and some of this. There's really different things. They don't have fresh vegetables except for cappuccio, kale, and this kind of winter things. Anyway, so yes, I was Coming Home was really about this incredible re-encounter with my world.
Was there anything in particular that you really, and before we get into your filmmaking and what you're trying to do, but anything in particular you really missed before you came home and when you decided to come home, food-wise?
Well, flavors. I didn't miss it because my idea, you know, when you're very young, I wanted to be independent, and Sicily was out, so I didn't miss it. I didn't allow myself to miss nothing because I was happy with my life. I was married, and I had two kids. I had a job. I was into my new life. So why should I miss Sicily? But it's true that the first question my grandmother would ask me when I landed in Palermo was, "What do you want to eat?"
that's Italian.
Yeah, that's very Italian.
It's Italian. That's Sicilian. That's right. Yeah. Now that's so you were in touch with all those flavors and those feelings.
Yes,
even though
I
you
was.
Were away.
I mean, I went every holiday.
Right.
I would go for Christmas. I would go for summer. And my mother used to come and visit, and she couldn't come in the house unless she had a bread from Palermo and this kind of stuff.
All right. Well, you also wrote, you wrote a book for the Global Series on the olive.
Yeah.
The series of single topic food histories. And what better place to write it from than Sicily, of course. But now you ventured into filmmaking.
Mm.
Was this something new for you?
Totally. No, mm. I'm not a filmmaker. I need to precise this because... when I arrived to Sicily, part of this overwhelming was also that I was seeing for the first time a lot of things that I had never really took care of or noticed, like hands moving in a certain way, doughs kneaded in a certain way, women waiting in a certain way for the bread to rise, and so I grabbed a camera, a little camera my cousin had in his cabinet, and I started filming like crazy, not knowing how to film, having never taken a camera in my hand. And I did a first short documentary, which was very naive, about the altars of St. Joseph that are made during St. Joseph feast on the 19th of March. And I started filming because I thought that this was the only way to really kind of capture all these things together. I mean, if you write, I really think you can't talk or think or write about food just sitting at a desk.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an incredible three-dimensional, four-dimensional, 20-dimensional topic that... So I thought that filming was the best way. So I started filming, yeah. But obviously, the second documentary, Amuri, that I made with the Kickstarter campaign, I called a director. I mean, I couldn't.
Well, the film that you're talking about, Amuri, the sacred...
Sacred Flavors of Sicily.
Sacred Flavors of Sicily. And it is available. You can see it on YouTube.
Yes.
And it is a beautiful film. I will compliment you
Thank
on that.
You.
It really is. And it does capture the, I think, the fervent feelings the Sicilians have for their traditions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Their holidays.
The holidays, the food.
All with food.
The food
all
is
with
incredible. Yeah. Incredible.
And I thinking about it, I thought, well, right. And then obviously the church is involved in these saint holidays, but they're in through the church, by the church, in Catholicism, they're called feast days, when actually it's foods that you can't eat often during these holidays, but it surrounds the foods that they're celebrating,
mm-hmm.
or the importance of the foods they're celebrating. For instance, you interviewed the anthropologist.
Antonino Butita.
Antonino, right.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave a wonderful description
yes.
of the Day of the Dead. And can you go through that and tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a very, for us, the Day of the Dead is probably more important than Christmas, in the sense that it celebrates the dead that come back, they wake up and they come back and visit the kids of the family. So your grandmother who's dead comes back, gets out of the tomb and comes back to the house and leaves some presents for the kids, her grandchildren or whoever in the family who wake up in the morning and find these presents. Now, this is a plot that we see in many, many feasts, right?
Right.
And what Butita is saying, and I totally agree, is that in cultures that are really, really strongly tied to agriculture, this idea of having a time that is round somehow, where birth and death are together, are tied together. Think of the act of putting the seed, of sowing a seed. A seed is dead, but has in itself life. You're putting it inside the ground, you're covering it, you don't know what's going to happen under the ground, and all of a sudden the miracle of life comes back. But in this space, when you don't know, what do? You pray the gods, or you pray the dead, or you pray whoever you want in order to have that seed germinate.
Right.
And this is exactly what happens in agrarian cultures. But since Neolithic time, it's not Catholicism at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we...
No, it's pagan. I mean, it's pagan rites.
Yeah,
right.
It's much earlier. Obviously, Catholicism has embraced this because they had to do with an agrarian culture. So for us... There are moments of the year, and one of them is the dead, which falls on the 1st of November, when Sicilians used to sow the wheat. So it's a very important date. Another big date is the 13th of December for St. Lucy, which is the shortest day of the year. So it's also the beginning of winter. So it's also, I mean, the moment where everything goes to sleep. According to mythology,
right.
it's everything is you close. It's Halloween in
it's
some
the solstice,
ways.
The winter solstice,
exactly. And then you have the starting again, which is Saint Joseph, the 19th of March, where you can go into spring, and you again new prayers and a new ritual in order to propitiate the gods, to have a nice harvest, to have a bountiful harvest. And then you have summer. It's all the calendar. What I tried to explain with Amuri is that there is a calendar that follows very precisely these desires and fear of the agrarian society.
And I think that it comes out very, very clearly. It comes across the Santa Lucia, the St.
Yes.
Lucy feast. What I think is that so many cultures have these holidays, these same holidays, but the Sicilians seem to have something personal tied to them. For instance, the Feast of St. Lucy, very much a Syracusan feast, right? She was
in Roman times, a beautiful
young girl,
didn't want to get married.
Would not marry the Roman god,
yeah.
Right? And she was persecuted and tortured,
yeah.
And so she became this famous martyr for
yeah.
them. But then there was on her feast day, or was it a ship named after her that came into the harbor in Syracuse?
Yeah, that's the legend. This is something very, very
that goes
repetitive.
So we're jumping up to the 17th century.
Exactly.
Then. She was from the 13th century.
Yes.
Right?
No, she was even earlier with Romans time. But this is the thing. The reason why all these feasts and saints were established in the 1600s, more or less. And so much later than and they had to build up a legend. And so the legend tells that the pest or famine was in the city, and all of a sudden a big ship full of wheat would come in the harbor, and so it's the day of the saints, so all of a sudden it's Saint Lucy who is sending the ship and all that stuff.
But they were, I mean, and this ship, or she, saved them in the 17th century, saved them from famine. They saved them
exactly
from all
the
this terrible
yeah.
hunger.
Yeah.
I mean, so much so that it spawned a new a new dish that to this day persists, right? Cuchilla. So the people jumped on the ship, gathered all the grain that was being shipped in, and cooked it without even grinding it or separating the wheat from the chaff. So tell us about cuchilla. What is cuchilla?
Cuchilla is a super old dish that appunto Mary Simeti recalls that probably it had to do with the, I don't remember the Greek word, but anyway, of a feast celebrated in Greece. I mean, it's the idea of eating non-grinded grains is really old. And it's obviously old because to grind the grain, it takes time, it takes tools, and probably at the beginning, they didn't do that.
Hand grinding, you can only make so much at a time.
Exactly. So cuchilla is basically whole grain, meaning not as you intend when you have a whole grain flour. It's the grain, the seed of grain, cooked for hours, and then in old times we used to eat it savory. You would just do a soup. Where I live in Valle d'Olmo, they do a soup with this grain, and they put a lemon, orange zest, and a few chickpeas and a bay leaf. And my grandfather used to eat it this way. Nowadays, they put cream on it, so they do it sweet. There's also a lot of tradition around that. So they do a ricotta cream, and they add the grains to ricotta cream. In Palermo, they do it this way, and it can be delicious if they don't oversweet it. It's delicious. Mm-hmm. And it's what you should eat for St. Lucie. You should not eat pasta, which is made with grind wheat with flour.
Interesting. But I love how there is all this background and stories attached to it, and that they carry it on, and they carry on the tradition. It's quite lovely.
Yeah. Of course, people eat arancina because it's made with rice.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is not exactly fasting or being religious.
And filled with maybe a little meat, too.
Yes, exactly.
But delicious anyway.
Yes.
Okay, that's all right. To eat, as long as they're not starving, that's the good thing. So all these holidays, and I urge you to go look at the film. As I say, it's on YouTube. It's called Amuri, A-M-U-R-I. And it describes all these different holidays and the food and the stories behind them and attached to them, and absolutely beautiful. So you are now embarking on a new film. Tell us about that.
So this is a new crazy project because I'm projectaholic, as people say. It's called Amaro. And it's about the bitter flavors of Sicily. So there's a funny story behind this new documentary, which is on Kickstarter. And we are done in, I think, 8 days. So we need a last push. Anyway, Amaro, we are very, very familiar with bitter flavors in Sicily, in Italy in general, mm-hmm. and in Sicily even more. Coffee, chicory, bitter almonds, lots of wild greens, artichokes, cardoons. There's a lot of stuff that are bitter in our culture.
Right.
But what struck me with this documentary, with this idea, I mean, I hope to make it, but what struck me is that Amaro is a flavor which we acquire with age, with time, because if you give something bitter to a kid, he refuses very, very likely. So Amaro for me is a cultural flavor, and somehow is a very good way to depict what I think about food, which is that food is much more than a recipe. Food is much more than a history. Food is a layered topic that encompasses a lot of different aspects. And Amaro is a bit like that, because Amaro is foraging wild greens, so it belongs to the poor people who used to go and forage to eat their pasta with something. It belongs to wealthy people that find into these very particular greens that are foraged only in certain time of the year. They find them a delicacy nowadays. It belongs to our culture because, for example, in Caltanissetta, which is a small town not far from where I live, there is a beautiful old market, and at this market there is a kind of team of people called the Fogliamari, bitter leaves, the bitter leaves guy, who have been making their living in 100 years harvesting bitter greens. So it's kind of an official job. But the interesting thing, obviously, these are poor people, is that this group of people in Caltanisetta are the first one in the procession carrying the Christ in the Friday before Easter. So, and while they carry the Christ, this corporation, this group of people, they sing very ancient songs that come from the Greek litanie. I don't know how you say that.
Litany.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this, when I saw this, I said, my God, this is incredible. I mean, there is such a depth of significance in all of this.
And the foragers always have this job.
Exactly.
To carry the Interesting. Yeah.
So this is what I want to document with my new project, Amaro. And I want to show this stuff, because I know that now Amaro is very fashionable in certain niche and people drink these Amaros and all this stuff. But
that'll capture an audience right there.
The story behind bitter and bitter greens and even bitterness, because life can be very
well,
bitter.
That's what I was going to ask you. How much, I mean, in watching the film about the, you know, the sacred holidays and the tastes of the sacred holidays in Amuri, they're celebrating, but they're also remembering the times that were so difficult when people had nothing and they were starving.
Yeah.
And you know, and of course Saint Joseph, the saint of the workers, you know, needing jobs. And
yeah.
So there is a sense of bitterness also tied to a lot of that.
No doubt, there is a sense of bitterness. There is a sense. I mean, how can you deny that there is a huge patrimony that is fading away?
Yeah.
So,
I think it's a beautiful thing that they carry this on. The bitterness, don't
it's
get me wrong.
It's beautiful that they carry this on, but of course they have a different idea of how to carry it on. So we have a flourishing world of sagre. I don't know how to translate.
Holiday, feasts, days,
festivals, exactly.
Right.
That are, I mean, half of the things are Chinese, with a lot of respect for China, but it has nothing to do with what we used to do. I mean, the world is moving ahead, not always in the best way. So this nostalgia is nice, is bitter, but it's also sometimes pointless. So I rather, but I mean, yes, if it goes towards a Chinese little banquet or stuff,
right,
well,
yeah.
Yes, I would say.
Toys and trinkets.
So I would rather, this way of documenting for me is very important, because not only I have people like you asking me about this and appreciating my efforts, but it's the only way I have to show to my people what they're losing and what they're doing.
That's an interesting point to think about and to stop on for a moment while we take a short break, and we'll be back with more discussion from Fabrizio Lanza. Stay tuned. As I've been getting to know Bob's Red Mill, I've been getting to learn a lot about the products they carry, and actually a little bit surprised. They're not just grains and flours, but good snack foods too. In fact, popcorn, which is one of my favorite snacks, is a product that they carry. And, you know, it was probably back in, you know, the 70s, late 60s, when all of a sudden nutritional yeast became the thing to use in your foods. Bob's Red Mill also supplies nutritional yeast. So there I have my snack ready made. Pop up some popcorn, and while it's still warm, sprinkle on a couple tablespoons of nutritional yeast. You're going to be surprised. You're going to think your popcorn tastes like it has cheese on it. Salty cheese. What could be better? Popcorn with nutritional yeast. And you can find these products, and so many more, at bobsredmill.com. And use the code TASTE25 for 25% off your order. Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Fabrizio Lanza. Fabrizio is an author, an art historian, a filmmaker, a cooking school director and instructor, a woman of many talents and a lot of history and knowledge about Sicilian culture and foodways. And Fabrizio, we were talking about the new movie that you are just finishing up. And I want to mention to listeners the Kickstarter for that. It is a project that, yes, needs an extra push and a little funding at the end, and it is on Kickstarter. If you go to Kickstarter and search Amaro, A-M-A-R-O, you will come to the Kickstarter page for that.
Thank you.
You say that you're very interested in wanting to preserve some of the culture and food traditions of Sicily. Look, Sicily is very hot right now, by the way, with tourists, you know. And do you see a lot of the traditional foods or foodways sort of getting lost or going by the wayside? What is it in particular, aside from these some of these customs of holidays we spoke about, but the bitter flavors, what is it you really want to preserve? What are you looking to do?
It's a complex question. On one side, I think food traditions are fading away like anywhere else. I mean, I don't think that Sicily is more endangered than the UK or America or any other place. I mean, food systems are pretty much at risk because the world has changed so much, and because there's no reason why you should break your back grinding hundreds and hundreds of kilos of wheat while you have a machine that does it for you. So this is normal, I think, and this we have to take it into consideration. So I look into this, and of course, if I find somebody doing things by hand or doing it the old ways, I document it, I film it, I'm very intrigued. I like to know how it worked in the past in order to understand better the present. This is for sure. And there's a great charm in these things, for sure. But another big thing that concerns me a lot is the fact that, I mean, here in America or in the UK, people are becoming, in small pockets maybe, but they are becoming very aware of where they need to go, of how they need to eat, how they need to treat the soil, how they need to be sustainable. I mean, all these questions are now on the minds and the brains of much more people than it was 20 years ago. So. Right. It's clear that we have to think and be aware of this stuff in a different way from 20 years ago. Now, in Sicily, we are pretty much backwards on this thing. There are, of course, people that are aware. There's an elite that knows and thinks and thinks properly. But there's a lot of people that live in lost villages like where I am, that think that the shortcut of, I don't know, destroying the old house and building a beautiful aluminium hut with dreadful trees that have nothing to do with the nature surrounding, and stuffing their kids with Nutella and hamburger is very cool. And this is a fact. This is a fact. So while the new world, the so-called new world, is looking at us as a possible model, because we are the old world, the old world is losing its own model. Mm. And this is something nobody talks about. Because I have all of you coming over there, you're enchanted by the shepherd who's milking the sheep by hand, who's making his ricotta, the best ricotta on earth, everything you want. But then the shepherd is there alone. He dreams about his aluminium window. He feeds his son on hot dogs and Nutella. So,
and he can't wait to escape someplace else.
And he doesn't even think of escaping. He doesn't even think or knows that he needs his son to learn English and to move forward and to go and see, I don't know, the cheddar, how it's made in the UK or anything else. Yeah. And this is what I want to do. I want to give back to my country at least an opportunity to open up and to see and to compare, because this is what you need to do to move ahead.
That's right. That's right. And it's, well, you had the opportunity to go and study abroad and learn other things. So I think the notion of wanting to give back something that suddenly, you know, you realize you deal with all these other people in the food world across the countries and know firsthand. If you can make a little dent somewhere in your country, that would be incredible.
This is what I would like to do. Yeah, this is finally. So going back to Amaro and Amuri, filmmaking and responding to your first question, if I'm a filmmaker, I'm not a filmmaker, but for sure, when my people see the documentary, they see something and they recognize all of a sudden something that is proposed to them in a different language, but they never would have thought that that was something valuable and worth filming.
Hmm.
You see what I mean?
It's just our holiday. It's just our celebration.
Exactly.
These are the breads we always make. Yes. These are the pastries we always eat.
Yes.
Just, you know, speaking of pastries we always eat, I don't think people can really appreciate, although I think I did a show on, if you look, I did a show on the pastries of St. Joseph's holiday with, I know very well that her name is, you know, just leaving my brain. I'll let you know. I don't think people really understand how elaborate this is. Can you describe a traditional home that does this large celebration for St. Joseph's?
Oof. Yeah. No, that's incredible. That's incredible. And it is, I mean, it has... I mean, it's a huge social topic because, first of all, the plot is that the people, a family makes a vow because they had, somebody in the family was very sick and he got rid of his disease and is good. And so they make a vow to St. Joseph, who helped that guy get out of his disease. So the vow consists in taking the largest room of your house, emptying it, and building an altar, which is huge, a big table.
As big as your room can hold, right?
Yes. And covering this altar with foods that have been prepared by the woman of the house in the 10 days before the 19th of March. And then this food is prepared to be offered to the three poorest kid of the village who represent the Holy Family. So there is the preparation of food 10 days ahead or a week ahead, and the consumption of the food the 19th of March. So the preparation of the food is very well codified. It's all the women of the family who gather, so you can imagine in those small villages where the mother-in-law would fight all day with the sister-in-law or such and such, all the things, the dynamics that are among women in a very close family. And then, so you had to gather together and you had to work together for 10 days or a week. Men were chased off. They had to take care of kids or go and forage because a lot of greens are required for the meal. Then there was the moment of eating and sharing the food. So when I filmed this thing, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. The three kids who were eating and tasting all the food, and also you should see the documentary, but the owner of the house literally serves these three kids and serves them food. And they have to taste everything. And whatever is left over is given to the three families of the poor kids. And then there is the whole bread thing, which is huge. Bread is a big thing in Sicily since we are a wheat country. And the breads are then given to the kids and to the family of the kids. One was given to me and it was very moving. Again, I think because... I never said this, but I think that in some ways these people that were filmed by me. I was alone at the time. It was when I attempted with my little telecamera. They had never had somebody taking pictures or filming. So I wonder what they thought. They didn't know where to put me in their imagination, if I was somebody sticking my nose in there, or if I was somebody good, if I was part of it.
Are you making fun of our traditions?
Exactly.
Or are you
I don't think
appreciating
they thought I made fun, but I was, on which side was I? It was very difficult for them to understand. And finally, one of the three kids gave me a piece of food, so I was kind of accepted by the whole thing, and so they ended up by giving me a bread, because hospitality is a great thing in Sicily. It was very moving.
That's interesting. I think it must be something southern across the world.
Sun helps. The sun helps.
The sun does help, right? Absolutely, and we could use a little of that. Well, I have never seen such elaborate pastry work as I see in some of those pastries and cookies that aren't too sweet, kind of almost a little savory.
No,
the tree of life and on top of like a fig paste or something. Just amazing work and the time and the love that goes into it. Or hopefully it's still love, but and lest people think that, you know, this is all just, you know, a film about, you know, religious holidays. Certainly not. This is a culture. This is a whole food culture, and these people had a structure. What gave them structure from the beginning of time? Religion or some type of belief gave them structure.
Yeah.
And then built into the structure were these holidays, which then they filtered with their food habits and their food culture. And it really is quite amazing to see, I think, for me, to see the Sicilian practices of some of these very old holidays, you know, being celebrated today in many of the same ways.
Yeah, unfortunately, less and less, because
not enough time. No. We're a modern culture. Exactly. Got to move on.
And also, I think part of is also there is a refusal. They refuse.
Because
the
it's tied
people.
To religion, you think? Or?
No, because it's. I mean, I forgot to say, but the St. Joseph was also a great way for social control. I mean, you could check on the poorest of your village and support them. It was that now there's no poor people anymore. I mean, everybody has food. There's another misery that I would call misery more than poverty. People are miserable because they don't have a job, they're pointless, they spend all their days in front of TV. But everybody has a TV and a cell phone. So there's no more really... I mean, in Sicily, you can live with really very little.
Oh, you said the sun, once again.
Yeah,
you know, the sun helps.
I mean, there are economies that go on with 15 euros a day.
Wow.
It's nothing. 15, 20 euros a day. You can have three meals with 20 euros.
So that'll get you by. Interesting. And it's an old culture made up of so many other cultures all wrapped up into one. It's a very unique place.
It is a unique place, yes. I would say so. I like to say it's the last of Eastern worlds and the last of Western worlds and the first of Eastern worlds.
That's
It's right there. Sometimes you think you're in Africa or in Lebanon. Other times you think you are, well, it's rare that you feel you are in Sweden, but I mean, it's a very different part of Italy. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Mm. And it's amazing that the religion even caught on. I mean, you know, pilgrims, you know, kind of stopped there and never didn't go on.
Yeah.
But, you know, it happened eventually.
It's a very Catholic country.
Yeah, interesting. Would you consider it still today a very Catholic country?
Yeah. Or? Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. Hmm. Not as much as it was with my father, my parents, less and less, but still, the south of Italy is definitely more Catholic than the north.
I think each generation must see that, you know, coming along.
Yeah.
So interesting. So many topics to talk about. So much history there. So much, you know. And of course, the food is you know, so intriguing to.
It's to a many good of length. Us. Length.
Yeah. Length. Length. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Well, so again, I urge you to go to YouTube if you can, if you're interested, to see Amuri, and if you get a chance and you're living on more than 15 euros a day, check out the Kickstarter program for Amaro.
Yes, please.
And we may have a full feature-length film. The Amuri film is only half an hour long or so.
Right? Amuri is 40 minutes.
40 minutes, okay.
Yeah. And the Amaro, if I get the fundings, I will do another documentary. I don't quite know yet the length of it.
Yeah. The Bitter Tastes of Sicily. What a wonderful chat, Fabrizia. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Again, this has been another Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.